This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Man, we got some real interesting stories for you on this show. First, I have a confession. There's only so much information I get as the interviewer of the Page Publishing Book Club. I don't know a lot about the authors I'm interviewing, so I have to get them to tell me everything. And Susan Calvin's story really took me by surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise, and her book is fascinating. It's entitled Changeling, The Unremarkable Story of My Remarkable Life.
I'm retired now. I used to be an Army helicopter flight instructor.
Wow, good for you. How long did you do that?
About 27 years.
Did you like it?
I loved it. The picture on the cover shows me in the cockpit of a Huey.
Nice.
Getting ready to take off on a night mission.
Nice. Is that what inspired your book, your career?
Among other things. Mostly I wanted to contribute. I've been a female for over half my life now, so I've got a lot of experience, and I wanted to share that with others because I thought it might help them.
You've been a female for more than half your life? Is that what you just said?
Yes.
Are you still a female?
Oh, absolutely.
So what do you mean by that?
You haven't read the book, have you?
No, I can't read 50 books a month. That's how many authors I interview. I only get...
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay. Well, the book is about my transition from male to female.
Oh, wow. Okay. Tell me about that.
I learned at a very early age that I had actually been born the wrong sex. I don't really know a good way to describe it. It was just like somebody turned on a blinding spotlight in my head when I was 6 years old and said, hey, you're supposed to be a girl. And I spent much of my life trying to deal with that. I did a couple of things that some people do, and which I'm hoping I can help people avoid. The two biggest mistakes they can make is getting married and joining the military. And I did both. One of the things I'm trying to point out is that you do those things trying to correspond to the sex that you're born with, and neither one of them actually works. Getting married will not make the need go away. I think some people join the military thinking that'll make a man out of them, and they'll quit having that need to be female, but it doesn't work that way.
This is my question. Did you fall in love? Were you in love with this person that you married?
Oh my gosh, yes. I still am. We're still very good friends.
Okay. Did you have children?
Yes, I have a daughter.
Nice.
She stood by me all the way.
So when did you decide to live the life that you were intended to live?
Well, what happened, and it was quite by accident, one day I saw an interview on TV of a young lady that was very attractive, and as I listened to her, she ended up telling my entire life story, and I'd never even met her. She was describing all the feelings and all the insights that she'd had that led her to become female. And to be honest with you, listening to what she was telling me almost knocked me over. And as I said in the book, I'm actually surprised I was able to fly that day without crashing. It was just that traumatic. But, you know, once the cat was out of the bag and I knew what I had to do, there was no going back.
So what did you do?
Well, I did as much research as I could on the subject. And, of course, everything I looked into confirmed what I knew intrinsically, that I should be female. And so over time, I was able to put everything together, actually begin living as a female, and eventually had surgery.
You no longer have your male parts.
Oh, no, that was done away with in the surgery.
That's
all my
be...
parts are female now.
And everything's normal, and you're able to have sex, and...
Well, yes.
That's amazing.
Although that wasn't the primary motivation for changing. And to be honest with you, even though I'm capable of it, I've never actually had sex with a man.
Are you attracted to men?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, at my advanced age, I don't see a relationship in my future.
How old are you?
73.
When did you go through the change?
Surgery was in November of 1982.
Okay.
In Trinidad, Colorado.
1982, man. Did they know what they were doing then?
Oh, yes. The surgeon that did mine... he was the top surgeon in the field at the time. Interesting aside on that, his name was Stanley Biber. He's now passed, but he was doing a lot of those surgeries, and a lot of the people that went to him actually became affectionately known in the transsexual community as Biber dolls.
Did your wife support you in that?
As much as she could, yeah.
Wow.
You know, you can imagine it was probably as traumatic for her as it was for me.
Of course. Yeah.
She was actually a great help. She gave me some good advice along the way. And we still see each other on occasion.
Do you have a partner in life?
No, I'm single at the moment.
Yeah. Is that important to you?
At my age, probably not.
Okay, so in 1982, were you still in the service?
Actually, I had become a what they call a Department of the Army civilian at the time, civil service employee. I was still flight instructing for the Army, but I was a GS-12 civilian.
Were you able to go through the change and continue what you were doing?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was.
Did you feel like you were being supported?
Some people were supportive and some people weren't. You have to consider that back then, this was all still very new.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't know how to react to it.
What is it that you want the reader to come away with?
What I'd like to do is to let people know that this is something that's not as uncommon as you might think. Thing is that most of us, when we go through this change, the motivation is to blend in and not to stand out. So there's a good chance that most people have actually met somebody like me and didn't even know it. But I want people to become comfortable with it because I think it's going to become a more common phenomenon.
Do you think there are that many people that are actually born and they're in the wrong, you know, they're the wrong sex?
You know, it's not uncommon. There are other animals in the animal kingdom that do it naturally. Not something unique to humans. The seahorse, for example, can change sex. And there are other animals that do that. And it's not common, but it does happen. Mostly what I want to do is to let people know that this is becoming a more common thing, although it's not a high percentage of people that go through this. Maybe 1% or 2% of the population will ever do this. But for the most part, we're just as real people as anybody else. And I kind of wanted to let people know from the family and friends side. Some people think that when they have a relative or a friend that goes through this, that they're losing their relative or friend, that they're essentially dying. Well, that's not the case. In a sense, they are. But they're going to come back as a much better person on the other side.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for sharing. Psychologist Dr. Jolene Arazi believes we need more of a certain kind of mental health education in schools and just in general. It's called control therapy. She noticed through her work with patients that regardless of what their issues were, she would hear the same thing. Why me? Why do I feel this way? So she started focusing on why people experience anxiety and found very often it's because of a lack of control. And this is what her book, Why on Earth Do I Feel This Way, is all about. The subtitle is Understanding Anxiety and Mental Health Through Control Therapy. And I tell you, Jolene, it just seems so obvious.
That's what I don't get. I'm like, because that's what I've been thinking the whole time. Like, this can't be new information. This can't be something new that's out there. And, you know, with all of my clinical training, all the theories that are practiced, nobody taps into control. It's listed as a symptom of anxiety, but nobody taps into it. And so when I focused more and more on the control aspect with my clients, that was what resonated with them. And then I would backtrack because I wanted to know, okay, everybody has anxiety. Everybody has their own, you know, symptoms of whatever, but they want to know, why am I feeling this way? Like, where is this coming from? And most clinical treatment really tries to target the symptoms. Psychiatrists, they'll list a symptom for them and then they'll give you a medication. They're not going for the root cause of it. So that's what I wanted to tap into. So I kept trying to backtrack with my clients to figure out, well, what is the common thread here? Trying to find a theme at the root of every single person. So no matter what people came into my office with or what diagnoses they had previously, if I focused on the control piece, it tapped right into what they were dealing with.
Yeah. Okay. So we should clarify that. Don't shrink. Say, you know, did your father abuse you? Did your mother,
right,
was she overbearing? And all, but it's right, not having control over,
yeah,
the anxiety.
It's not necessarily can't controlling the anxiety necessarily. I mean, I guess to an extent it is, but it's really controlling the circumstances that you're experiencing. So in those examples that you just threw out there, I can't control what my parents do. I can't control the environment that I'm in. And if I can't have that control, then my anxiety spikes up. One other common misconception that people have is that anxiety and depression are two separate things, and they're not. So I use a scale in my book to gauge the level of intensity of anxiety. So 10 being the worst, that's where we're having intense anxiety or overwhelming anxiety, panic attacks, you know, whatever yours looks like. And when we're at the top of that scale for a prolonged period of time, we can't stay up there. Our brain can't stay up there. We need to have some kind of relief from that awful feeling. But when we don't get the help that we need, we feel like we hit a wall. And I explain this in my book too. I explain it from the neurological perspective, because that was the only information I could come across that actually taps into anxiety and control is coming from the neurological perspective. And I was able to get concrete information about what's neurologically going on in your brain when you have anxiety, and they link it to a lack of control. So neuropsychologists have been on this. But when I reached out to one of the neuropsychologists who I reference in my book, he was asking me what I do to treat it. And I was thinking, well, you know, don't you know how to treat it? Like, you know what's going on in the brain. And he said, yeah, I know what's going on in the brain, but I don't know how to treat it. And so that blew my mind, because I'm thinking, I don't get it. I don't get why this is not out there. So I explained to him my scale, and I used some cognitive behavioral therapy to work on bringing the anxiety down on that scale. But when that anxiety is high on that scale, that's when our personal sense of control is low. And so we basically want to shift that scale, bring the anxiety down, and bring up that increase that personal sense of control. But when we don't have that help to bring down the anxiety in a healthy way, our brain is on overdrive and we feel like we hit a wall. And that's where more of the depression starts to set in, because of what's going on in the brain. The brain is flooded with these neurotransmitters, and then all of a sudden they're shut off. And that's where the depression comes in. So when depression hits, you're not going to see your typical symptoms of anxiety that you've had. You're going to have more symptoms of depression. So depression is more of a continuum of that scale. And that happens when you haven't, when you've had prolonged anxiety, you've already been battling anxiety for so long, and your brain hits that wall.
Do you make recommendations in the book as to how you can bring that anxiety mm-hmm. level down?
Yeah. So I make recommendations for some cognitive tools, really identifying some of the thoughts that really trigger our anxiety. So basically, when we experience a situation that we interpret as not having the level of control that I want or I need, and that feeling will lend itself to thoughts called these automatic thoughts. These are the thoughts that pop into our head and really trigger that anxiety.
The thought that says I'm a loser, they're going to find out I'm a fake, they're going to find out right. I don't really know what I'm doing.
Okay. Yep. And so those thoughts are often assumptions or anticipatory thoughts. I'm anticipating something to happen, but they're not necessarily true. I don't have evidence to prove that they're actually true. But once I start assuming something, I believe that it's true. And then one thought will trigger another, and that'll trigger another and another and another. And they just snowball until I'm thinking about the worst case scenario. And I become completely consumed in those thoughts. And that's where the anxiety lives. So we become so consumed in those thoughts take complete control over our focus. And we're not able to focus on what is actually happening in the moment. What's my priority right now? Or what is within my control right now? I'm not able to even identify any of that, because that anxiety is consuming my brain, and it's causing certain parts of my brain to react. And so I can't access my frontal lobe, which is more that logical thinking, higher ordered thinking.
So what do I do?
So we want to practice identifying those automatic thoughts and becoming more aware of them, because most times we're not necessarily aware of them, because there are oftentimes thoughts in the back of our mind that I'm not consciously thinking about, but the worries are there. So I want to practice identifying, okay, if I'm higher on that scale, use that scale as a reference. If I'm above a 5, I need to take inventory of what's going on. What am I doing? Who am I with? What am I supposed to be doing right now? Or what am I thinking about? And identify those thoughts, and then review those thoughts and ask yourself, do I have any evidence or proof that they're true? Do I know for a fact that those thoughts will happen, or that they're definitely true? Because more times than not, we don't have that proof. But again, once we start thinking something, those thoughts are off and running. So we want to try to shift our focus back to what is actually happening in the moment. So that's the cognitive shift. That's the main practice in my work with my clients, and that I also discuss in the book, is doing this cognitive shift, shifting our focus from those anxiety-provoking thoughts to what I'm doing in the moment. So you're basically retraining your brain to think differently than what it's been used to its entire life, because our brain doesn't naturally think in a logical step-by-step way. We have to train it to do that, and that's what we're doing. In the end of my book, I do have an outline of what parents can do. And a lot of that is really what they can do to help their kids as well. So you can do it individually, or you can, you know, parents can apply that for their kids as well. So it's kind of an outline of step by step what to do, you know, identify those thoughts. And then after that, the next step is reviewing them. Where's your evidence or proof that that's true? And so it kind of walks you through the whole exercise of what to do to practice that cognitive shift.
So yeah. Is your book available in your office?
I have talked about it in different schools. And so I'm still trying to push it out to the schools as well. before the pandemic, I was scheduled to do a lot of hands-on work in different schools to really help change the culture and really push mental health education, because I feel like that's where, you know, the work needs to be done. Just by giving kids this understanding, it needs to be destigmatized. And that's what I try to do with my book. I want everybody to understand you have anxiety, you know, and it does serve a purpose, but when it gets to be overwhelming, then it starts to interfere with our life. And that's what we need to pay attention to. But every single person has it. So it doesn't mean one person is mentally healthier than the other. It's that we all have it. And if we don't address it, it's going to get to a point where we crash and burn, or it turns into depression or something else. So if we can help teach kids just basic tools when they're younger to understand that they can get control over things, but have to learn. It's basically learning how to problem solve is what it is. Another thing that I feel is really interfering with mental health is parents wanting their kids to go to these, you know, Ivy League schools and be the best of the best, that kids are not taught how to focus on themselves. They're taught to meet other people's expectations, and they have to do what other people tell them to do, or what their parents tell them to do, or what their parents want them to do, or what so-and-so is doing and what so-and-so wants them to do and what they're expected to do. So they're putting all of their focus and energy into doing what they think they should be doing per other people. They're not taught how to focus on themselves and think for themselves and think about, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to go to college after high school? Is that even for me? Do I want to go to these schools? You know, my parents are telling me I should go to these Ivy League schools because they're the best schools in the country, but is that what I actually want? They're not allowed to think for themselves. They're not taught that. And so my book really emphasizes the importance of focusing on yourself and think about, well, what's in my best interest? You know, so-and-so may be going to this university, but do I have to keep up with that person? Does that mean I'm going to be a failure in life because I don't go to this school? No. You know, if I focus on the fact that I know I'm a hard worker, I'm a good student, I hold myself accountable, I do what I need to do, and I'm a responsible person, then I'm going to be successful. But that's not what is drilled into their heads. You know, they're drilled, you know, they get drilled in with, you need to have these test scores, you need to have these grades, you have to take AP courses, you've got to have all these activities on your resume. And then, you know, you still not may not be good enough for this school. So I try to flip the lens for students and think, and try to force them to think about, well, what do you want? If you go and look at a school, instead of them interviewing you, you interview them, have them prove to you why you should go there. If I'm going to be giving you my money, what are you going to do for me? You take back that control. You exercise that interview. Don't think that you need to prove yourself to them. If you know you're a good student, you're going to be successful no matter where you go. But don't let that school take that control away from you and make you doubt yourself and make you think that you're not going to be successful because you're not good enough for their school. That's not for them to determine.
Good for you, Jolene. Thank you. And we'll be back right after this.
Have you written a book and want to get it published? Then now's the time to call Page Publishing at 800-204-6099 and do it immediately. You see, they're looking for authors of all types of books. And unlike most publishers, Page Publishing will take the time to review most of the books submitted to them. And they'll even give you their feedback. And if they like what they read, Page Publishing will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, the Apple iTunes Store, and other outlets. They'll handle everything. Copyright protection, printing, cover art, publicity, and editing. So if you've written a novel, a children's book, a cookbook, inspirational work, a book of poetry, or biography, and want to get it published, then you need to call Page Publishing and do it immediately. Call 800-204-6099 now for your free author submission kit. Your road to fame and fortune could very well start with this simple phone call. For your free author submission kit, call Page Publishing at 800-204-6099.
We're back on the Page Publishing Book Club. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Check out how a guy just walking across the street becomes not only the inspiration for Lynn Perez Hewitt's first book, but for a trilogy. The PR professional turned author lays out the story behind Measured Time, Book One, The Traveler.
It's so interesting. My husband, who is in cybersecurity, and he was at a day-long conference in Boulder, Colorado, when we still lived in Arizona. So I'm at the Boulderado Hotel where we're staying, and they got a great bar. They've got a patio. This was September in Colorado. It's beautiful. So I'm sitting on the patio, having a beer, waiting for my husband to come back, and I look across the street, and at the light, a guy walks across the street wearing a brown suit and a fedora. And I looked, and I thought, well, that doesn't fit. And I always have a notebook, and I started to write.
That's
like, okay, where might somebody have come from looking like this? The story is a Japanese-American physicist gets his PhD at Stanford, December of 1941. Then he and his family are pulled into an internment camp. In 1943, when Robert Oppenheimer is building out the science team to build the bomb, he has read about Nick's work in teleportation, in moving atoms across space. He decides he wants him for a military intelligence project. So he finds him in the internment camp, pulls him out, takes him to Los Alamos with his team from Stanford. And they work on a parallel project to the bomb. Comes time in September of 1944 for a human test. Well, Nick obviously has to be the one to do it. So he steps into the machine, they power it up, and he steps out in southern Arizona in 2008. And then, who does he find? Does he come back? And there you have it. I am writing three in this series. I am part of the way through book two, and I know what book three is going to look like. Living in Colorado, we actually went to Los Alamos twice. And, you know, walked the area, got books on the local history, got a feel for it. In fact, the photograph on the cover of the book is a clock, actually, that we bought at a thrift store in Colorado, in Palisade, Colorado. And looking through the face of the clock, you see the picture of a desert. That is Los Alamos. And it's a photograph my husband took when we were there.
So you're a PR person. Mm-hmm. And how do you promote a book in a pandemic?
Social media. And actually, I had a young man working for me as an intern. So I have hired Jacob, and he's doing my Instagram. He takes photographs. He's a wonderful photographer, and we create the imagery, and then we design the arc of what we want the posts to be each week. And sometimes he drafts, and then I refine. Sometimes I draft, and he gives me feedback. And ironically, this is the week that I'm going to make the announcement to all of my Facebook followers and all of my LinkedIn followers that this is where my energies are.
Nice job, Lynn. Looking forward to those other two books. Adam Harris is in Washington State, living the dream of a young writer. He loved telling stories as a child and now takes us on a sci-fi journey beneath the sea where humans have been forced to survive in his novel, From the Deep.
I've just always been interested in the ocean and the idea of maybe having habitats that people could live in and just trying to sustain life down there. So basically, the surface of the Earth has been rendered uninhabitable by nuclear devastation, and now the people that are still alive live in underwater habitats to stay away from the radiation. And in one particular habitat where these people are living, they have to deal with an outbreak of a parasite. Slowly, the habitat ends up being destroyed by the parasites as, you know, the people try and fail to stop it. It ends with only one person making it out of the habitat at the end, and it ends up being destroyed when the reactor that powers the station is destroyed. She does have a family and just parents, but they were dead before the story starts, and after that, she's really on her own. She does have some friends in the station with her, but she doesn't really have anybody she's super close to. And then, of course, after everybody dies, she's on her own and just kind of wishes that they were there with her and doesn't know why she gets to live and they don't.
So I take it there's a sequel.
Yeah.
So how did they figure out how to build these underwater habitats?
There was a research group that existed before everything got destroyed that was already building that kind of technology, and they just finally had a chance to implement it when things were going bad. So they already had some of this stuff set up before, and they just went into overdrive building a lot of it after they needed it.
What is it that you want the reader to come away with?
I guess it's just that we have to be careful. You know, it's really, really easy for us to destroy ourselves and end up in a situation like this, and we just got to all be thinking about that and trying to find better ways to resolve our issues.
Is there any issue in particular that really bothers you?
Just the general, just the constant strife and people always, feeling the need to constantly become better and more powerful, you know, just an arms race.
So did you enjoy the process of writing the book?
Yeah, I did. I always like writing. It's a very relaxing process for me. I've always really liked the sci-fi genre in particular, and that's part of why I decided to write this story, because I like that genre a lot.
Right. So how's it going out there in Washington with the pandemic? Are you able to promote it in any way?
I've been lucky to have a lot of family and friends who've been promoting it by word of mouth in combination of social media, and I've been doing a few things. I'm trying to make a website right now to help promote it. Basically every way I can, it's not physical. We're still having outbreaks. It's not really any better. We're still in full. We just lifted our stay-at-home order, but we're still wearing masks and things like that.
Don't you feel like we're living in a sci-fi horror story right now?
Honestly, with everything that's been going on the last couple of years, it sometimes I just have to sit back and remind myself that it is all really happening, because it feels like it's almost too crazy to believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, this all could come right out of a book. Sit there and go, that could never happen. So, I mean, ideally, I would be able to try to reach out to bookstores and do actual physical events.
Okay, well, someday that's going to happen. So you hang in there, man.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Yeah, you know what, Adam? Someday there will be book signings in person. But you know what? You know what I really think about is, will we ever live in a world without masks? You know? I mean, here we are a year after the pandemic started. And I remember reporting from Penn Station about, you know, how you could not buy a mask. You could not find a mask in a store. But very few people were wearing them, other than, you know, the people who always wore them. But now we know how easily germs spread on crowded streets and subways and concerts and ball games. And, you know, I wonder how long it'll be before we see a majority of people without masks. And that said, I wish this was a horror movie, because it would be over in 2 hours instead of over a year. Just wait till the books drop on this pandemic, the movies, the Netflix series. I mean, they're probably being written right now, but nobody has an ending yet, you know? Anyway, that's it for this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Thanks for being here. Let's do it all over again when you download the podcast at 710WOR.com. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Catch you next time.